taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you are everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome to the Constitution Study. This is where we read and study the Constitution to teach the rising generation to be free. I am glad you could join me. You know, one of the things that I personally hate my entire adult life, I have hated to be micromanaged. I know there are some situations where details are important, but I hated being micromanaged, and I loved working in jobs where I would be given a general task to do, and it was my responsibility to get it done. I'm not saying I didn't get advice from others, but I didn't have a manager breathing down my neck about every little jot and tittle of what I was working on. Yet today, it seems more and more governments, including and especially the federal government, well, they want to micromanage our lives. Case in point, in the recently passed infrastructure legislation was yet another mandate, this time to car manufacturers, about what you need in your car.
Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18 of the Constitution is the necessary and proper clause. It delegates to Congress the power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. Now, does that mean Congress can pass any law which they think is necessary and proper? Enter the new law, H.R. 3684, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Now, in Section 24-220, Congress finds it necessary to require new cars to include drunk and impaired driving technology. The question we should all ask, is that a power vested in the government of the United States? I'm sure there are plenty of Americans out there who think requiring technology put in cars to prevent drunk driving is necessary. Let me remind you what William Pitt the Younger said. Necessity is the plea for every infringement of human freedom. It is the argument of tyrants. It is the creed of slaves. Like most Americans, I think operating a 2-ton machine while impaired is dangerous and irresponsible. Does that mean it's within the power of the federal government to impose their opinion of how best to deal with this problem on the American people? It's not a question of whether the technology is good or bad, or even if this is a viable method of reducing drunk driving. Instead, it's a question whether the federal government has a legitimate power to do so. Now, Congress found several reasons why they should pass such legislation. Congress finds that alcohol-impaired driving fatalities represent approximately 1/3 of all highway fatalities in the United States each year. In 2019, there were 10,142 alcohol-impaired driving fatalities in the United States involving drivers with a blood alcohol concentration level of 0.08 or higher, and 68% of the crashes that resulted in those fatalities involved a driver with a blood alcohol concentration of 0.15 or higher. The estimated economic cost of alcohol-impaired driving in 2010 was $44 billion. According to the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, advanced drunk and impaired driving prevention technology can prevent more than 9,400 impaired driving fatalities annually, and to ensure the prevention of alcohol-impaired driving fatalities, advanced drunk and impaired driving prevention technology must be standard equipment in all new passenger motor vehicles. Let's assume that the first four statements are true. Does that mean Congress has the legal authority to tell car manufacturers that certain technology must be included in their products? Does Congress have the legal authority to tell the American people they must have and pay for this technology in their property, whether they want it or not? Where do property rights, liberty, and responsibility come into play? Now, the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution says, "No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law." Now, in H.R. 3684, Congress once again is taking control of your property. When you purchase a vehicle, it's your property. This legislation claims to allow the United States to further take control of that property by defining what technology must be in it. Furthermore, it claims the power to restrain your ability to purchase a vehicle without this technology. Now, in his 1828 dictionary, Noah Webster defined liberty this way. Freedom from restraint, in a general sense, and applicable to the body or to the will or mind. Civil liberty is the liberty of men in a state of society or natural liberty, so far only abridged and restrained as is necessary and expedient for the safety and interest of the society, state, or nation. A restraint of natural liberty, not necessary or expedient for the public, is tyranny or oppression. You may be asking yourself what this has to do with drunk driving laws. Well, if civil liberty is a state of society where you can live free, where the only restraints allowed are those that are necessary to the safety and interests of society, then we need to ask if Section 24-220 of H.R. 3684 is necessary for the safety of society. Driving while impaired is not only a danger to the driver, but to anyone else around them. Therefore, a law punishing the act is necessary to the safety and interests of society, and not a violation of one's liberty. Does that, however, extend to the new vehicle requirements in H.R. 3684? The primary purpose of the advanced drunk and impaired driving technology described in H.R. 3684 is to prevent the driver from driving while impaired. In other words, it's an attempt to save the driver from him or herself, which then, by extension, makes society safer. Like any technology, it will not be 100% effective, meaning there will be times when an impaired driver will not be stopped by this technology, and other times when it will prevent a non-impaired driver from using their property. Not to mention the likelihood that there will be people who will find ways to defeat this new technology or simply purchase older cars that do not include it. It imposes a restraint on all citizens as a punishment for the actions of a few. If drunk and impaired driving is as dangerous as Congress says, though, why not include this type of technology? Put another way, if you have nothing to hide, why oppose the legislation? The answer is simple. Although I have nothing to hide, I have everything to protect. Impaired driving prevention technology has been available for years and has been a requirement as a punishment for those convicted of a crime. On the other hand, this legislation treats everyone as guilty, requiring they prove they are not drunk without any probable cause. It deprives them of the liberty to not have to deal with or pay for technology without due process of law. It also deprives them of the control of their property without due process of law. In the end, this makes it a violation of the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. Now, Congress claims the power to legislate motor vehicle safety standards under the Commerce Clause, which reads, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Now, since most vehicles sold in the United States are manufactured either outside of the country or within a handful of states, the car you drive was most likely sold over state lines. Hence, Congress claims the authority to regulate any aspect of motor vehicles. Was that what the framers of the Constitution meant by regulating commerce? Now, Noah Webster defined regulate as to subject to rules or restrictions, as to regulate trade, to regulate diet. This legislation, and indeed most of Title 49, regulate the product, not the commerce of the product. Can the regulation of commerce legally be used to violate the civil liberties of the American people? Now, I have to admit, this law posed a conundrum for me. My first instinct is to oppose it simply because, once again, we see Congress telling the American people how to live their lives. There are parallels between Section 24-220 and H.R. 3684 and legislation such as fuel mileage, helmet, and seatbelt laws that, while well-intentioned, violate the rights of motor vehicle operators everywhere. On the other hand, drunk and impaired driving is a danger to others in society, which brings into question if it is a violation of civil liberty. So I believe those who drive while intoxicated or impaired should be held accountable for the damage they do. I'm also in favor of sentences for drunk or impaired driving that require some sort of prevention system for the guilty. However, is the just response to treat everyone as a drunk driver until they prove otherwise? Did our founding fathers imagine the Commerce Clause to be used not simply to regulate commerce across state and national borders, but as an excuse to regulate anything that goes across these borders? See, regulation of transportation is not a power delegated to the United States, so it remains with the states or the people. Yet Congress claims the power to regulate motor vehicle safety simply because the majority of vehicles were, at some point, sold across state lines. With all of the reports about stricter laws and harsher penalties regarding drunk or impaired driving, is Congress meddling in something that's already being dealt with at the state level? And what about innovation? See, H.R. 3684 looks to passively monitor the performance of the driver. There are already technologies available to do so, and more in development, from lane diversion and obstacle alerts to monitoring the driver's eyes for attentiveness. While some of these technologies are available in modern cars, some are not ready yet. So if the Secretary of Transportation is allowed to pick which systems will be approved, we'll have no idea how many other technologies will not see the light of day, all because Congress thinks they know better than the states and the American people. If history is any guide, the people who wish to drink and drive will outsmart any ideas Congress can come up with. Which brings me back to William Pitt the Younger. Necessity is the plea for every infringement of human freedom. It is the argument of tyrants. It is the creed of slaves. The argument of Congress that this must be done to keep people safe is just another tyrannical attempt to punish the innocent for the crimes of the guilty. And while I believe the drunk driver should be punished for the harm they do, I am not willing to enslave myself to government simply because they say so.
See, what we forget are these laws, these edicts, these are just more mandates. These are mandates, whether it's a mandate on the fuel economy of vehicles sold or the equipment that must be included. And like any mandate, they assume that the government has the power to tell you how to live your life, what you should buy, how you should use it. Now, are there people who misuse motor vehicles? Absolutely. And they should be punished for doing so. But any government that can mandate that what goes in your car can mandate pretty much anything in your life. You want to know where government got the idea that it could mandate people take an experimental drug? Because for decades, they have been mandating people have certain requirements in their vehicles, have certain features in their toilets, not use certain light bulbs, and on and on and on. And of course, these things don't happen without consequences. According to military.com, a total of 169 Marines have been discharged because they refuse the illegal government mandate. Now, of course, the Marine Corps says, well, listen, the speed with which the disease transmits among individuals has increased risk to our Marines and the Marine Corps mission. Of course, they mention nothing about does it make the Marines physically unable to do the job? Are we, because again, we're dealing more with Omicron. According to the CDC, 95% of the cases are Omicron, which have mild symptoms. See, I don't remember the military requiring a flu vaccine. And we've had decades of flu, and we've had decades of flu vaccine. But this is, again, the government saying, we know better than everyone, and we will violate our own laws because we know better. Because according to the law, this is still these quote-unquote vaccines are technically still under emergency use authorizations, meaning that you have to be informed this is an experiment. And under the uniform, and I've been told this by a lawyer who was formerly in the military, according to the Code of Uniform Justice, I'm sorry, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, you cannot be discharged for refusing to take a drug under, or any pharmaceutical under an emergency use authorization because it hasn't been fully tested yet. What are we doing to our military? What are we doing to the men and women who have pledged and taken an oath to protect us when we say, you must be medical guinea pigs or you're not allowed to serve? Now, 169 out of the entire Marine Corps, it's not going to make the Marine Corps ineffective. But think about it. First of all, this 169, they're just the first. But where are they? Are these career people? Were these enlisted Marines that you know, plan to do, you know, 2-4 years and then go back to civilian life? Or were these career military? Were these officers? Or were these non-commissioned officers? As I understand, NCOs are the backbone of any military. What is the history? What is the brain trust that is being depleted because the government thinks that they can eradicate a virus, a respiratory virus? We haven't been able to eradicate a respiratory virus in our history. We still have colds. We still have flus. We have other coronaviruses that go around from time to time. But no, government has claimed the authority to mandate that you must be experimented on to see if we can get rid of this particular virus. And no, it's not limited to the military. See, Dr. Aaron Carradine, a longtime professor of psychiatry and the ethics and director of the ethics program, was fired by the university because he sued the university because their COVID vaccine mandate did not take into consideration natural immunity. In other words, if you've already had the disease and you have a natural immunity, there was no exception to the vaccine mandate. He sued and was fired for it. So much for medical ethics. And he said, but that's a university, Paul. Yeah, it's the University of California, meaning it's a state-run university. And they're doing so because, again, we have a government that believes it has the ability to mandate to the people what they put in their body. Now, according to the doctor, the university leadership was not interested in scientific debate or ethical deliberations. When I was placed on unpaid suspension, I was not permitted to use my paid time off. That is to say, I was ordered to stay off campus because I was not vaccinated, but I also could not take vacation home because I was not vaccinated. Are you finding a pattern here? It wasn't a question of whether or not the doctor was a danger to others. If he is home, if he's not allowed on campus, why can he not use his vacation time? Why could he not use his sick time? Because this was not about a medical decision. He mentioned the university leadership was not interested in a scientific or ethical deliberation. They wanted him vaccinated, and he refused to comply. And now it has cost him his job. Now, hopefully, he has been his stand for ethics have been sufficiently seen that someone will offer him employment for the work that he does. But think about this. If you live in California, you are paying to remove this man from a job, not for scientific reasons, not for medical reasons, not for ethical reasons, but because the state wants everybody to take an experimental drug. The state is mandating. It's why I made up those masks. You can find them on constitutionstudy.com and on constitutionscholars.com. You can find a mask. It says, mandates are tyranny, worn under duress. See, if you go to a business that requires you to wear a mask and you decide wearing the mask, it's worth wearing the mask to do business with that place, you might want to let them know that you're doing it under duress. But this isn't simply a mask. See, a mask is an inconvenience. A mask is a temporary infringement. A vaccine is not. Putting an experimental drug into your body is not. But government has claimed the authority to mandate, to tell you that you must put this in your body if you wish to live as a free citizen in this country. And the more we sit back and let it happen, the more we stand by and go, tiss, 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 look at this poor doctor who lost his job, and don't get up and get in the face of the tyrants that are doing this, the more it is spread. 2021 was the example. We watched while government entities mismanaged COVID. from the not simply the mask and vaccine mandates. Those are tyrannical. But look, why is it the states with the highest COVID rate are the ones with the greatest restrictions? Why is it Florida, with the least restrictive, have also routinely, not spikes, routinely been the lowest infections, the lowest hospitalizations, the lowest death rate? Because government never checks to see if what they're doing makes sense. They don't stop to ask, is it legal? They simply do it. And, you know, you never find a government actor says, you know what, I was wrong, and I changed my mind. It almost never happens. And it's not like there isn't evidence that what we're doing is wrong. Sweden refused to lock down, even though they're surrounded, in the EU, surrounded by people who've locked down. But you know what you don't hear about Sweden? They have the lowest excess mortality rate of any European country this year. In other words, the scientists look at, on average, there are a certain number of people who die every year in a country. That's you expect it. Anything above that is considered an excess mortality. Now, it could be caused by any one of a number of things. But if you have a country that did not lock down, has the lowest excess mortality rate, why do we think lockdowns worked? You look at what happened in New York. We have Omicron coming out. Now, Omicron, while extremely contagious, is also the least virulent of all the strains of COVID-19. It has mild symptoms, rarely involves hospitalization, very, very few deaths, very few. Yet what is the first thing New York does when Omicron shows up? They go back to doing what hasn't worked in the past. They lock down. They refuse to accept the science, the studies. They simply lock everything down, go back to do what they've done before. Now again, I've lived in New York, where people tend to be packed on top of each other. It is almost the perfect storm for spread of a respiratory virus. But instead of looking at the effectiveness of their policies and then maybe making changes when they don't work, instead of looking at the data, the scientific data, the data right out of the CDC that says, the data out of the EPA that says masks are, most of the masks people wear are 40% effective. Most of them. Some are better. Instead of looking at the CDC data that says, you know what? The vaccine does not stop the spread of COVID. It may make the symptoms more mild. It may mitigate some of the symptoms. But see, they're not worried about the symptoms. They're not worried about hospitalizations. They're simply saying, cases have gone up. We must lock down. We ignore reason. We ignore logic. And governments are mandating how you live your life. And they do it because we let them. This COVID pandemic will never end until we make government stop making the same mistake over and over and over again. I believe it was Albert Einstein that said, doing the same thing repeatedly, looking for a different outcome, is the definition of insanity. That describes so much of the country today. But it doesn't have to be. Because if you look at the Constitution, if you read it and understand it, guess what? We don't work for government. They work for us. They get their jobs from us. They get their pay from us. The rules they work by are set by us. All we have to do is enforce it. But too many of us are afraid of our creation of government. Are afraid of our employees in government, will not hold our employees accountable for their bad actions simply because they're in government. Just because you get a government paycheck doesn't mean you're a genius, doesn't mean you're infallible. It simply means you got a job working for somebody else. And as long as we sit back and let and allow the bureaucrats and the elected officials and the tyrants believe they have the authority to tell us how to live our lives, whether it's involved what you put in your car, to what you put in your body, to how you go about and live your life. We are, until we stop that, we will continue to be subjects and slaves of these petty tyrants. I'm not surprised people who are drunk on power are acting on it. I'm not surprised that people who want power head for government where they can act on it. That's a fish swimming in water. It is natural. But the American people bowing down in slavish devotion to their employees as if they are somehow magically endowed with superpowers of intellect and the power to mandate how we live our lives, that bothers me. Benjamin Franklin said, "We had a republic if we can keep it." This is the American people throwing the republic out the door. This is the bum rush of a republic, a bum rush of freedom, a bum rush of liberty, because the American people are not only allowing it to happen, in many cases, they're begging for it to happen. And it's not just happening with drunk driving. It's not just happening with COVID, but I'll have to deal with that after the break. So please head over to constitutionstudy.com, find out more about the work that we're doing. Take this opportunity. It's a new year. Take the opportunity to read and study the Constitution. There are plenty of resources. You can find them there. You can also find them at constitutionscholars.com. I run both websites. You don't have to pay a fortune for it. There are free resources. There are also paid resources. But take this time to read and study the Constitution and teach the rising generation to be free. That was the admonition from John Jay. That is how the Constitution study functions. If you want to study the Constitution with others, I am starting later this year an online Constitution study. Go to constitutionstudy.com/study, find out more, register. There'll be a free portion and there'll be a paid portion. But you can try it absolutely free. Don't take my word for it. You can try it absolutely free. If you don't like it, don't pay for the rest of it. But if you try it for free, if you sign up, you'll get a discount on the paid version. So give it a try. Again, that's constitutionstudy.com/study. Also, maybe you made a New Year's resolution to live a better lifestyle, to be healthier. Maybe you decide to take vitamins. I remember my wife convincing me, it's finally time for me to start taking vitamins. Well, the thing is, vitamins haven't changed since the 1930s. And sometimes, you know, we use vitamins for a lot of things, but sometimes what you really need is that focus. You get, like me, to the end of the day and your mind gets to wander and it's hard to focus on a task. Well, HealthyCell.com has focus and recall. So forget the energy shots, forget the energy drinks. They're full of caffeine and sugar. Sure, they get you focused, but they also get you wired and often lead to a crash. But Healthy Cell has focus and recall. It boosts your short-term focus, helps your long-term memory, and does so with a nice travel-ready gel pack. Now, as an America Out Loud listener, you'll get 20% off your first order. Try focus and recall or any of the formulas or any of the subscriptions. But make sure you use Out Loud at checkout to get your 20% discount. That's right. Go to HealthyCell.com. Choose whatever you want for your first order. Go use a coupon code Out Loud at checkout, and you'll get 20% off your first order.
I'm excited to talk about a new product from HealthyCell, AC11. This is a patented bioactive extract of Uncaria tomentosa from the Amazon rainforest. It supports cell DNA repair and health span. It's a dietary supplement. I'm excited to try it. Many are interested in longevity and attenuation of senescence. We know that telomere length and other biologic measures are related to senescence in clinical and preclinical studies, particularly of animal models. And I can tell you as a doctor, dietary supplements do hold the promise of attenuating repair and damage in our body due to stress, physical wear and tear, sunlight, etc. And there's a tremendous opportunity for supplements to help us in this area. And so Healthy Cell has brought a product to market for you to try as part of your health portfolio. So please go to healthycell.com and in the promotional code, list out loud for 20% off your first purchase of products from Healthy Cell. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Because of COVID-19, many Americans worry about their health four times a day. That's 112 times per month. But by simply keeping our immune system strong, we can stay healthy and put our worries at ease. One little known way to do this is by taking AC11, a patented supplement from a plant in the Amazon rainforest. Studied for over 20 years and backed by over 40 scientific peer-reviewed studies, taking AC11 has been proven to extend the life of immune cells called leukocytes, allowing you to boost immunity naturally. Go to healthycell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of AC11. That's healthycell.com, HEALTHYCELL, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
The America Out Loud family is comprised of patriots in the true sense of the word. We know that if America fails, the world will fail. It is incumbent upon us to carry the torch for liberty and the Constitution to help save America for future generations to come. AmericaOutLoud.com. It's a fight for the soul of humanity.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study. Today, we're talking about mandates and this general idea, the arrogance of assuming that some people have the authority to tell other people, they know better how other people should live their lives. And it's simple, you know, we've been talking about mandates, but it does go beyond the idea of mandate. It's the, I will get my way no matter what. I am right. You know, it's like I said, it's the arrogance of knowing you're right. Now, we all have these things that we just know to be true. We know are right. They are in the warp and woof of our being. But that doesn't mean that we're right. And it doesn't mean we have the authority to tell other people they should agree with us. So there are people, especially people who are drawn to power, who are so sure they're right. Well, they'll do anything to get their way. One of those people in charge today is, well, it's the president. It's the commander-in-chief. It's Joe Biden. See, now, he has basically said, in order to get H.R. 1, the what should be called the federal overtake of the American Voting Act, he's willing to, with his words, do whatever it takes. Now, part of the problem with H.R. 1 is, well, they can't get it past the Senate. Why? Well, because the only people really supporting H.R. 1 are primarily the Democratic Party. The Republican Party is opposed to it. Now, I'm not saying this is a, you know, that makes the Republicans virtuous, but they are opposed to this legislation. I believe most likely because they believe that it'll keep them from winning elections, but they are. And since our Senate is equally divided with the vice president as tiebreaker, they can't get it past the Senate because the Senate has a rule. You see, in the Senate, debate doesn't end until the Senate agrees that it ends. See, unlike the House, the rules in the House, they set aside a specific amount of time for debate. But in the Senate, debate goes on until 3/5 of the senators vote to say, okay, we're going to stop debate and we're going to move on to actually considering the legislation. That is called cloture. Now, the term for not allowing debate to close, to holding the floor is called a filibuster. And the idea was, if you ever watched the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, he actually filibustered. He got up and he talked and he would refuse to release the floor and prevent the Senate from going on. Now, that's not how they do things today. Basically, they promise they're going to filibuster, but they don't actually filibuster. But we still have this idea of cloture. You need to end a debate and move on to considering the legislation. You need currently 60 votes. And the Democrats don't have 60 votes. By the way, that's not uncommon. For years, you would have a situation where the majority in the Senate did not have a 60-vote majority. They would require the participation of some from the other side. It is meant to be a, you know, if the Senate's meant to be the saucer, the cooling off house, that's part of how it happens. You have to get agreement from a supermajority of people that we've had enough debate, we're going to actually vote on this. Doesn't mean you're voting for the legislation, just that you're actually saying we're going to stop debate and call for a vote. Now, this has been used for decades by the minority party to hold up the works of the majority party, much to the majority party's frustration. This has nothing to do with the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't require this. This is a rule of the Senate, and the Constitution does say each house has the authority to set up rules for their procedures. This is a House rule. Now, the quote-unquote nuclear option was first considered involving legislation back in the early 2000s. And what ended up happening is a Democratic majority leader decided that they were going to stop using the filibuster they were no longer going to require cloture. It would take a simple majority vote for cloture for legislation for appointments to the Supreme Court. Well, that came around and bit them in the backside because, of course, when the Democrats did it, the Republicans just said, well, we're not simply going to use it for the Supreme Court, we're going to use it for lower courts. And now we see people calling for it because the Democrats cannot get H.R. 1 passed. This is a classic example it's a temper tantrum. I can't get my way following the rules, so let's change the rules. This is a temper tantrum. Now, the fact that the President of the United States is participating in this temper tantrum doesn't bode well for the future of our country. During a recent interview on ABC, the President was asked, he says, you know, it's been a year. There's almost a year. Nothing as much happened with H.R. 1. The president was asked, are you prepared to support fundamental changes in the Senate rules to get this done? Biden answered yes. He was asked, what does that mean? It means whatever it takes, change the Senate rules to accommodate major pieces of legislation without requiring 60 votes. Whatever it takes. I want what I want. Whatever it takes. See, this is where mandates end up. See, it goes beyond we can get a majority of people to agree to this. This is the arrogance of, I know what's best, and if I have to break it to get what I want, I will break it to get what I want. And I'm not saying I'm pro or con the 60-vote majority. This is a simple question of, these are the rules. They've been the rules for decades. Once again, we see politicians that are willing to break the rules or change the rules to get what they want. I mean, this is the equivalent of saying, I'm not winning the game, so let's change the rules so I win. We've seen this before. This is how despots act. I don't get the action. I don't get the outcome I want. We change the rules, whether that be in legislation or in constitutions. We've seen it before. See, yes, it's the act of a despot, but it's more than that. As I said, this is a temper tantrum. And when you stop and realize what this is grown men and women stamping their feet because they didn't get their way, whether it be Biden, whether it be Schumer, whether it be Pelosi asking for it. These are grown men and women who aren't getting their way, and they're going to stomp their feet and they will change the rules to get what they want. This is the political equivalent of a two-year-old throwing themselves on the floor, yelling and screaming and pounding their fists. Now, can they get away with it? Well, according to Senate rules, if I understand them properly, they can change the requirement for 60 votes with a simple majority. So there is a way for them to do this. Again, that's the rules that the Senate has set up. But there are two things I want us to consider. Is it right? Is it right to set up a rule that says we need 60 votes to do something and then require a simple majority to change that? Those are the rules. They're constitutionally sound because the Constitution gave the Senate the authority to determine their own rules for their proceedings. That's the case. What does it say about our employees in the Senate? The people that we voted for to represent our states, that they're willing to make this change, not because they find the current rules objectionable in toto, but because they can't get what they want. In other words, they didn't choose to get, they aren't talking about getting rid of the filibuster when there was nothing on the line. You know, when they not only had the majorities, but when they were passing legislation, no one said, you know what, the 60-vote rule makes no sense, let's get rid of it. Only when they couldn't get their way. Now, here's the other thing to consider. And it's something that I doubt many of the people calling for this have considered. One of the things we have to consider when we're looking at legislation is how would our political opponent use it? If you're going to set a rule, how would your political opponent use it? If you're going to set a precedent, how would your political opponent use it? We've already seen what happens. Very often, this very rule turns around and bites you in the backside. I'm not saying that the filibuster rule is a good thing or a bad thing. It is a thing. And for what is supposed to be the cooling saucer for legislation seems to be being led by a group of hotheads. It's what happens when mandates become, when your desire to implement your way must be fulfilled no matter what. But that's going on in the Senate. And the Senate isn't the only thing. See, mandates run throughout our bureaucracy. For example, the Department of the Interior of the Biden administration announced the approval of two solar projects in California and a third that they expect to be approved shortly. Now, these are big projects. They're costing hundreds of millions of dollars. They're supposed to produce hundreds of megawatts of power, and power, you know, was 100,000, 132,000 homes in California. What do they need federal approval for? See, while these are private projects, they're going to be on public land, I believe federal land, which is an interesting question. Why does the federal government own so much land in the West? I did a little bit of research for this when I wrote my book, and Congress is allowed to add new states to the Union. That's what the Constitution says. Now, when Congress did this for many of the Western states, they said, here's the deal. Before you actually become a state, there's a few things you have to do. You have to have a state constitution and stuff like that. Oh, one of the things you have to do is you have to turn over all of your public land to the United States for us to dispose of for you. Now, at first thought, well, you know, is that really such a bad idea, right? We're going to take state, what is territorial land, public territorial land, and we're going to make it federal land, not state land, and the federal government will dispose of it for you. Except they didn't. In other words, the federal government made a condition for new states to join the union effectively to turn over all public land to the feds. And then the feds now control vast proportions of many Western states. I mean, was it Nevada? They own something like 70, 80% of the land in Nevada. They own huge swaths of land throughout the West and use that to control what happens within the state. So here we have three privately funded projects that are going to take place within the state of California. At least I believe they're happening within the state of California. They're to provide power to citizens of the state of California. No problem with that. But the federal government gets to decide what they're whether or not they can do it because it's on Bureau of Land Management land, BLM. See, BLM has what they call this Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan. They want to develop renewable energy sources. Again, I don't have a problem with developing sources if they make financial sense. If three privately funded companies believe they can make they can do this, they're privately funded, they want to at least break even, if not make a profit, I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with the federal government coming in and saying, well, no. See, we took that land when California became a state in order to hold it in trust to dispose of it. But rather than dispose of it, we're going to hold it as a stranglehold. Again, mandates. Now the federal government gets to say whether or not California can actually have these privately funded projects. See, my issue isn't whether or not these projects are logical or not, whether they're effective or not, whether or not they make sense or not. It's simply a question of why have we allowed the federal government to extort the states that enter the union to turn over land that should be a state, it should be state land. If it was public property in the territory, why is it not public property? Why is it not state-owned property when it becomes a state? Why not let the people of the state determine what to do with it? Because it gives the federal government control on everything from the BLM projects to cattle grazing to water rights to oil drilling to... It's another method of control. And those controls are then developed based on mandate. See, BLM wants to develop renewable energy sources. The federal government's deciding what can be done with this public land in California. Now, they did it because, well, the people of California agreed to this. They signed the compact. They under the condition that they do this, they agreed to it. A bad part of the deal. I think that the federal government should be required to dispose of land within a certain any land that the federal government were to assume when a state joined the union should be disposed of by the federal government within a reasonable amount of time. There should be a time frame set with which they must dispose of the land. Why? Because the federal government is not authorized to hold land for any reason they want. You see, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, I believe it's Clause 17, says Congress has exclusive legislative control over the District of Columbia and other places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. See, it doesn't say that the state has to hand over the land. In fact, in order for Congress to have control over that land, it must be purchased from the state. But you can't purchase it from the state if the state is required to turn it over as a condition of becoming a state. Furthermore, this is not land for forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. This is land for land. This is just to own and control land, to be able to manipulate the states by controlling territory in their property or in their within their borders. And by allowing the federal government or any government to exercise powers they're not authorized to, there are consequences. For example, according to the head of the U.S. Energy Alliance, they're saying that the Biden administration's policies are driving up the cost of oil and gas. If you go to the gas station, you fill up your car, and you notice it takes a lot more money, you can thank the Biden administration. If you are paying for fuel or natural gas to heat your home this winter, and the bill has gone up, in many places they say you can blame at least the Energy Alliance. U.S. Energy says you can blame the Biden administration. But I have another question. Why does the Biden administration get a say in it? Again, the executive branch acts under legislation created by Congress, and Congress can regulate interstate commerce. It doesn't say anything about taxing. It doesn't say anything about energy policy. Now, Congress can create excise taxes. Yes, they can. Direct taxes against people have to go through the states. Not going to get into that here, but the policy of creating energy and the policies for regulating the industries that create energy are not a power delegated to the United States. Therefore, this is a usurpation of state powers. And as we've centralized the control of energy, we've put the control of energy effectively in the hands of one man. So we are, in the matter of months, we went from a net importer of power to a net exporter of energy of power. Importer of energy to exporter of energy, or exporter of energy. Then a few years later, within a month or two, we go from a net exporter of energy to an importer of energy, because the policy is now in the hands effectively of a single person, because we let Congress tell us what they can do rather than the other way around. We allowed them to mandate energy policy, even though the Constitution never authorizes this. Now, I've been talking a lot about the feds. The states are just as bad at it. There is a bill in the New York Senate that wants to criminalize what they refer to as harmful content. Now, the basis of the bill, as I understand it, is they want social media companies to be forbidden from having content that promotes things like force or self-harm or anything that includes a false statement of fact or fraudulent medical theory that is likely to endanger the safety or health of the public. Again, this is in the New York State Senate. So let's start with point number one. Who decides what is fraudulent? All right, because remember, we have people saying, well, this is true and that's not. This is true and that's not. But it was interesting. I was listening to a podcast the other day, and the person was talking about, we have all these experts. You get an expert to tell you anything you want. Yeah, you can. So I have experts that tell me that ivermectin is dangerous. I have experts that tell me that ivermectin is wonderful. I have experts that tell me the vaccines work. I have experts that tell me the vaccine doesn't work, because these are experts detached from data. So who gets to decide? And should it be the government of the state of New York that gets to decide? Now, I'm sure many people out there jump, First Amendment. This is not a First Amendment issue. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. This is not Congress making the law. This is the legislature of the state of New York. However, it does violate New York State's Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. Since every citizen may freely speak, write, and publish his or her sentiments on all subjects, being responsible for the abuse of that right, and no law shall be passed to restrain or abridge the liberty of speech or of the press. This proposed legislation abridges the liberty of the press by claiming the government has the authority to determine what can and cannot be published based on what they think is false or not. This is the dystopian future we've been reading about for decades. Because, perfect example, in the same day I found that article about the legislation, I found another one that's saying that Governor Kathy Hochul of New York has declared that that racism is a public health emergency. Now, explain to me how racism is a public health emergency. Well, according to the governor, she said, for far too long, communities of color in New York have been held back by a systemic racism and inequitable treatment. What does that have to do with public health? And oh, by the way, Ms. Hochul, you're a member of the Democratic Party. Your predecessor was governor for years. They've been in control of that state for years. You're telling me that the Democratic Party has been implementing systemic racism and inequitable treatment in the state of New York for years, decades even? So, you know, now she's suddenly declared it's a public health emergency. Prove it. But you see, she doesn't have to prove it. She simply states it's a public health emergency, and everybody in the state of New York is supposed to bow down and agree that they're going to give up more of their rights because this governor said racism is a public health emergency. That she implied that the state of New York has been systemically racist for decades, and she, who's worked for that government for many of those years, has done nothing about it. This is political grandstanding. This is nothing but political grandstanding, because now that we've shown that for a public health emergency, the citizens of the state of New York will give up their rights in the name of a public health emergency, all she's done is say everything's now a public health emergency so she can destroy the rights of the citizens she has sworn to support. She's sworn to protect. She's destroying the Constitution of the state of New York. Shouldn't be a surprise, they've been doing it for years. It's one of the reasons why I left that state, because I got tired of watching them destroy the Constitution of the state and of the United States. And as long as the people of New York State keep letting this happen, you will continue to fall deeper and deeper into tyranny and despotism, and you've got no one to blame but yourself. Now, you can find out more about my show and get all the latest podcasts. Just go to AmericaOutLoud.com, and under the menu, look under our shows or schedule. You can find the Constitution Study and help share the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends.